Hey, Tom.
Okay, I'd like to call to order the meeting of the Legislation Committee for Monday, May 10th, 2010, which is run by legislators Burton, Rogowski, Harkin, Burrows, Myers, Williams, Alfreda, and Mezzano, who is walking into the room to greet his lunch. We're starting at 12:42. Two items on the agenda today. The first is a coming back to a few open items on source of income, and then secondly, eminent domain. I have three items on source of income that we need to follow up with today. One is three questions that we asked the county attorney to answer in the last meeting. Secondly, reviewing the sunset provision that has been revised after the last meeting, and three, to have a discussion on the issue of penalties, which we left open at the last meeting. Mary Lynn and Justin, can you just go over the questions that we had from the last meeting and what and the answers that you can provide us, please?
Okay. Well, with respect, Mary Lynn Nicholas Brewster, Associate County Attorney from the County Law Department.
Justin Eden, Assistant County Attorney.
With respect to the penalties, because I know there were a few questions regarding the DTPA, the county attorney's office.
Well, wait a second. Sorry to interrupt you. There were three specific questions.
Right, those three questions.
We're going through those now.
Okay. The three questions that you asked were with respect to the Emergency Tenant Protection Act of 1974,
right,
regarding what would happen should the proposed source of income law have a repeal provision, a sunset provision. There were three questions. One was, yeah, what happens if you rent to a recipient of Section 8 subsidy, the sunset provision triggers the repeal, and what happens if the Section 8 tenant thereafter vacates? Should, you know, or must the landlord continue to accept Section 8 recipients? Then there was a question regarding what happens to the rest of the building if that ETPA the Section 8 tenant leaves the ETPA regulated apartment. What happens to the other apartments in the building? Does the landlord have to rent to the other the other apartments to Section 8 recipients? And then finally, what happens with respect to major capital improvements, and whether a Section 8 recipient must pay those rent increases for the improvements? The county attorney's office is still working on those issues, so we're not yet prepared to answer those questions. However, there was a fourth question with regard to penalties, and that we can discuss. I know there was some discussion as to what penalties and exemptions there are currently and how they play with respect to source of income. Currently, there is a single-family home exemption under the Fair Housing Law, and that is found at 700.21C1A. That's the single-family home exemption, and that would say that an owner of a single-family home can rent or sell that home without violating the Fair Housing Law, but there are some restrictions to that. One, the owner cannot own or have interest in more than three single-family homes at any one time. The house cannot be sold or rented with the services of a broker, okay? And the house cannot be sold with publication, posting, etc., advertisement. So if the single-family home meets those exemptions, then you would be exempted from the Fair Housing Law. There is a religious organization exemption to the Fair Housing Law. That's under 700.21C2A. And religious organizations can show preference to members of the same religion as long as they're offering non-commercial or free housing, such as shelters or nursing homes. There is a private club exemption. Again, a private club is not prohibited under the Fair Housing Law from renting or limiting that rental to of non-commercial lodging to its members, as long as the club is not, in fact, open to the public. And that's under 700.21C2B. Then there is the Mrs. Murphy exemption. Again, this covers owner-occupied buildings of not more than four families living independently of each other. And if it's owner-occupied, no more than four families, then that particular dwelling is not subject to the fair housing law.
Did I include the owner in the four?
I'm sorry?
Is the owner one of the four?
Yes, yes. It's owner-occupied dwelling. And then there is exemptions for housing for older persons as well. Now, in the proposed local law, one of the requests by the committee in the past was that we enlarge the Mrs. Murphy exemption and allow that exemption to cover a second dwelling up to four families. So that is in the current fair housing law. I'm sorry, the current proposed source of income law.
That's section 3.
That's section 3. Let's see.
Is it?
Let me just pull that out. And that's section 3 of the law. Okay. And that would be subparagraph V of 700.20 right. of the laws of Westchester County, and that would be
3D.
Subdivision F3. Right. So what we attempted to do there, because the committee requested, is to expand the Mrs. Murphy exemption to include one additional building. So what we were trying to do there is we didn't want, or at least the committee had indicated they wanted to limit this to mom and pop, you know, they wanted to enlarge the exemption to cover mom and pop landlords who may not have more than two homes that they own. As long as you had an owner-occupied dwelling, no more than two buildings of up to four family, then we were going to exempt those two buildings. So that was the attempt by the law department to create a greater exemption, Mrs. Murphy Plus, as we termed it. So currently, under the source of income, you would have what is currently exempt, which would be, you know, what I just discussed, right. And then the additional building. And of course, we exempted cooperative apartments and condominiums, et cetera.
And Mrs. Murphy lives in one building, and she doesn't live in the other building.
Exactly. So now, up to two buildings, and you're exempt from the law for source of income law for those two buildings. If you own more than two, then obviously you wouldn't be exempt. You would only have the Mrs. Murphy exemption, which is the owner-occupied building, because that would stay in effect. You would not get the additional buildings.
Any questions for Mary Lynn on this issue? I none? Okay. I have to say I'm disappointed that we don't have the answers to the other questions. I don't think they're that complicated, and I don't know when you anticipate having the answers, but I think there was no excuse for not having them today. I don't blame you guys, but I will take that up with the county attorney directly as to why we don't have answers to those questions. Second item on for today was...
I have a question.
Yes.
Just maybe take a couple minutes to discuss with the committee. Maybe I missed that meeting. I don't remember when we discussed this little expansion of the Mrs. Murphy section in Section 3 we just talked about. I missed that last meeting. How did we arrive at that as a decision, that you can have one you live in and one other and not do three? Like, what was the conversation where we just made the decision as a committee? I just missed that meeting. If someone could tell me, why we picked one plus one? Why did we pick one plus two? Well, I'm just curious what the debate
was. The chair apparently has the answer, so we'll let the chair. I'll defer to the chair.
As the former chair of the Committee of Government Operations, we had this significant discussion on Mrs. Murphy Plus. We did that over several meetings, and basically the it was trying to match the federal guidelines that basically said when you had three units or more, you were basically a commercial location. And the accommodation in having discussions with members of that are proponents and opponents of the situation came up to Mrs. Murphy's Plus, which was an owner-occupied building that was already covered under fair housing law, plus one more. So that was the combination of that. So we had several discussions. I mean, it was hours of discussions on this particular one when we had presentations from the BRI that came in, et cetera, et cetera. So that's how we came up to that particular thing.
So.
It's after significant negotiation.
On this topic?
Yeah, I just have a question on this. Does that mean if you own a 1-4 family building but don't live in it, it is included in the statute?
That was correct. If you had a single, if you lived in a single family, I mean, we went through all these combinations, Mr. Chairman, through you. If you lived in a single family house and you own a 4-unit building, right, and you did not live in that fort, that would be included in the source of income, right?
Okay. All right, thanks. Okay, let's go to the issue of...
It was really for the small... It was for Mrs. Murphy,
yeah,
the small...
Mrs. Murphy plus, you get... Mrs. Murphy's building plus one other building of four.
Let's go to the sunset provision.
I think it was actually Abernathy.
It was me.
I think it's pretty clear.
It's Mrs. Murphy's law. That's how we got it.
Mrs. Murphy is mother of Murphy.
It's funny, Tom walked in. I asked the question because Tom called me over the week and talked about Mrs. Murphy exemption. And I asked it because he wasn't here, and then he walked in the middle of it. So can Tom at least follow up what he talked to you on the phone about?
Yeah, my concern was, I know what the intent was, but when you read the language, when you put the two together, we had to ask for a chart to show what it applies to and what it doesn't apply to. Because when I read the language, it doesn't come out the way it's intended to be.
Well, the county attorney's office just went through all of the exemptions in the law and gave a very clear explanation. And I know, as far as I'm concerned, I'm satisfied with the explanation.
On that particular, through that one?
Well, Tom, why don't you tell us what's not clear to you? And in Tom's defense, he's got serious child care issues today.
Okay.
He's got his kid with him. He had to bring him here, so.
Thank you.
I wonder, am I your attorney now?
Yeah, that's
Go ahead. What's your concern?
If a person owns a two-family house and lives in it, owns a single-family house that they rent to their child and another single-family house that they rent to their child, those are all covered?
No.
They're not.
Because it's three,
I think
it's
they are.
Three separate dwellings.
Three separate dwelling units.
No, because it's only two buildings.
Three buildings.
Right, we only cover two buildings.
No, or anything. If it's three buildings, you're covered.
No, we're not. No. We're covered two buildings.
No, that's the exemption. Beyond that,
right.
That's my point.
What you have
more
than within the law.
Oh, we're saying
more than
the
two
same
buildings,
thing in opposite
right,
ways.
Within
once
the law.
Once you have more than two buildings...
Right, you're under the law.
You're under the law.
Right.
So if you rent to... You know, this is the Mrs. Murphy. This is what happens in every one of our villages in this county.
This is
a serious concern, because the intent was to get the professional landlords and not to the Mrs. Murphys. And it is very common for us, particularly the old timers in this county, to get a little bit of money and bought a house for $200,000 and another one for $150,000, another one for $150,000, and they're all covered. And that's the concern that I have, that now all of these buildings are all covered. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If I may, we had this conversation 2 years ago, this exact conversation,
right,
at great length, in great detail,
correct,
and arrived to this accommodation because of issues you raised.
I agree, but I'm saying the language doesn't do what it's... I objected to the language at the time, because it's an exception to an exception. It's not an affirmative, okay? It's an exception to an exception.
Is there a simple fix you would recommend? I'm sorry.
Well, sure. That's why I asked the county attorney to address this very issue.
I think the law is clear. What you're proposing is expanding the exemption beyond two buildings. The law is clear. It only applies to two buildings, where the owner lives in one building and owns another building up to four units and doesn't live in it. It's clear. What you're proposing is to expand the exemption. And I think we've been through all of this. We've reached a compromise.
So we're saying that if somebody owns a single-family home,
yeah,
or a two-family home and lives in it, and owns another two homes, might be another two-family home where the daughter is living in it or something like that, then the source of income legislation will apply.
I mean, to the third one.
As a matter of fact, with Mr. Abernathy's explaining, is absolutely the opposite. Because you just said they're renting the two other units to family members, right? That's what you're saying.
Right.
They're renting the two single family houses to family members.
Yeah.
And with...
Their own building is covered by source of income, even though they live there.
Go back to that exemption.
No, it is not. That is not what was just explained. That the building that they live in is...
Well, if we can explain it, what the committee had proposed is that anyone who owns more than two buildings is viewed by the committee to be in the business of renting. So if you own only two buildings, we're going to give you an exemption for those two buildings should you occupy one of the two. Once you begin to own three and more, you are going to be now covered by the source of
income
law.
You lose all exemptions.
You lose all, you cannot lose the Murphy exemption. That is static in the law.
You lose the plus one.
You lose the plus one and thereafter, because once you own more than two, the committee made that determination, you're in the business.
Then you're commercial.
Wait, and the main exemption, 700.21C,
right,
applies to as long as the owner does not own more than three homes, three single-family homes. So, you know, there is enough play in there, and you could start postulating hypotheticals till this exemption here,
3D, contradicts the exemption in the law.
No, it doesn't. We just went through it. It does not contradict it.
Read the
it
language.
Supplements it. I did read the language. We just read the language. It supplements it.
Yes.
If I may.
Does anybody? Yeah.
If 300C, 3C specifically says housing accommodations otherwise exempted by 721C.
Yeah. So it supplements it.
The Mrs. Murphy exemption applies under 721C, no matter if you can own 20 buildings, but the one up to four family house that you live in is always exempt under Mrs. Murphy.
And
so you always retain that one.
The single home exemption is still applicable regardless, because we've already stated that all the exemptions under 700.21C stay and remain. So the D is an addition to whatever exemptions are already there. So those are not removed.
All right, so we're dealing with a building for not more than four families. Okay, so it's a family, it's four families or less.
Yeah.
Okay?
I'm going to occupy it.
Living independently of each other, provided that the person who owns or has ownership in such housing accommodation owns or has ownership interest in no more than one such housing accommodation.
In which such person
does not act. Okay.
Tom, most of us have read this, and I don't think we're going to spend the time parsing this now. This exemption has been a proposal for the last...
I know, and it's troubled me ever since then. Well, I've raised the issue over and over again.
Does it trouble anybody else on the committee?
Okay,
that particular exemption? No?
I have some questions about it. I mean,
you just asked them, and I thought we answered your questions.
I'm not allowed to ask any further.
You have more questions?
Yeah, I'm not allowed to ask any more.
What's your additional question?
Well, I'm not quite sure. We seem to have made like a legislative determination by this section that someone who owns three, four family homes is a commercial landlord.
Yes. Yeah, we made that determination. Yeah.
You all think that?
Yes.
Okay. I don't know if I think that.
Okay. Well, you don't have to think that. We're not trying to tell you.
I'm just
think the same
throwing it out there. And if we, by the way, this is Murphy Plus One. All these meetings, was that all done in community service, or we also do it in legislation?
Well, I remember.
So in my defense, I've never had a chance to debate this ever. This is the first time it would happen in another committee.
We have discussed. No, it's been discussed in legislation. There was some joint meetings.
I apologize if I missed that meeting.
Pull out all the minutes.
I apologize if I missed that meeting.
Pull out all the minutes.
First time I remember seeing this.
I have all the minutes. It's been discussed. What I'd like to focus on now is the sunset provision, which was amended to make it clear that the sunset provision, the law expires 5 years after the effective date of subdivision B, because there was a delay period for this law kicking in.
6 months.
There was a six month delay, so we wanted to make sure the 5 years expired after the 6 months, and
it's really five and a half years.
That's it. It now says the local law shall expire and be deemed repealed after 5 years after the effective date of subdivision B. And subdivision B says that the prohibitions become effective 180 days after passage.
Mm-hmm.
So, is that, anybody have any questions about that?
Yes.
Yes, Legislator Burke.
We added this provision for what reason?
Because we wanted to make sure you had a full 5 years since the law was in effect for the sunset. Or are you questioning why we
added
the
sunset? Why are we sunsetting?
Legislator Mazzano proposed it.
My theory was that there is a debate, not everybody here. I think there's probably people with three different viewpoints on the issue. And that is, people have got up about 10 times here and said, there's no need for this law. Some people think there is a need. Some people don't think there's a need. Other of us are wondering if there's a need. So because of that, I thought we would take 5 years of experience with the law and take a look at the end of 5 years whether this law was really needed. And we'll have some real data after 5 years for that. Whoever's on the board, that maybe all you'll, maybe we'll all still be here. Probably not. Make that determination at that time.
So it was maybe judges, yes.
I don't know about that.
All right. But then the question arises, if there is no need for it, the chairman has embarked on a very ambitious program of seeking to delete laws that are either have expired or ought to have expired because they just were found not to have any value. Why would you not allow that process to continue? Why would you specifically go after a housing discrimination law and for the first time, aside from the fact that it's just the first time? I don't see the need for it, I guess is the answer.
My answer to that is, that's a good point, and there's another way to do it. But I think because there's empirical, people in this industry have testified there's no need for the law, that there is a question of fact on this issue, whether there's a need for the law. We can all make a determination what we think, based on what we heard, but I don't think it's a closed question in my mind. I don't think it's been resolved that it's clear that we must have this law. I've never even taken a position on this issue yet, publicly, because I've been listening to the debate for 2 years. I think it's an open question. I mean, I'm willing to potentially proceed with this law, but I do think that we should take a breather after 5 years. And by the way, we put sunsets on lots of laws we do. It's not like this is the first time we've done a sunset clause. Because there's a question of fact on this, whether the law was needed, because both these sides are so diametrically opposed on whether there's need for a law, I thought the sunset clause was a useful compromise.
Is this a deal maker for you for that?
Well, don't put me on the spot like that, but...
Why not?
Because I'm still listening to debate here. But I think it's a good addition to the law.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And on this particular item, I think that it is a reasonable and rational compromise to say that in 5 years that we will determine whether or not, based on the history of the law, to determine whether or not it needs to continue. And it was a fair point to be put into this particular piece of legislation. To say, no, let's take a look and see the history and see what things have happened. We certainly have had testimony on both sides. Mr. Mazzano has pointed out that said there's a great need for it, and there's members on this committee that believe that. That's part of the reason that we advanced this legislation. And there's been equally impassioned arguments on the opposite side. So to move the legislation forward, if this particular item helps members to be able to make a decision to say, you know what, let's take a look, let's see how things are going to go on this particular thing. 5 years is a good enough time frame to take a look at it, and certainly I you know, as a person that advanced this legislation in the very beginning, would be supportive of that particular.
And as a sponsor as well, I agree that it makes sense to look at this given the conflicting testimony that we had over the time. So,
and as a third sponsor of this, I'm skeptical, but I'm willing to go along if this would get us across the goal line.
Okay. Any other discussion about the sunset provision? Final issue which Legislator Mazzano raised was a proposed amendment to the penalties to strike the $100,000 willful, wanton, or malicious penalty.
No, the $50,000 civil penalty.
Reduce.
Leave the $100,000.
Right.
Leave the $100,000.
Yeah, my proposal.
And strike the $50,000.
Take the $50,000.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were reducing the $100,000 to $50,000.
You know what? I don't have it in front of me. I apologize,
I
everyone.
Hold on. I thought you were striking the 100 and leaving it at 50.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
But I was making the 50 for egregious conduct.
Right.
Well, yeah. Not just 50. So yeah, that's why I misunderstood what John was saying.
I would like to, my response to that is, since I'm still concerned about the proper interpretation of willful, wanton, and malicious, and the issues that legislators not be raised is what willful really means. Is it means an intentional act. That means anybody that violates the law is acting willfully. I would like to table that issue because it implicates the entire fair housing law. And I promise we will discuss it.
What? And lots of other laws, too, which use the same
Phrase. It could, yeah. So I would like to take a look at your proposal in terms of the definition of the proper interpretation of willful, wanton, or malicious, and to see whether we should change that
criteria. So not the amount, but even change the criteria.
I understand. Yeah, I think we should look at both.
If you look at the New York State law, New York City law, it says that the civil penalty should only be imposed if it will serve a public purpose. We don't have that.
Right.
Maybe we need that.
Right.
And I certainly want to let our executive director of the Human Rights Commission comment as well. We also looked, Ms. Braithwaite, at the federal law and noticed that its penalties were less than our law. So I don't think we could get into trouble if we changed our penalty and made it different. But would you like to comment on that?
I just want to say that the law as it stands now today, if you make any substantive changes to the law,
right,
and that would be a substantive change, it's you're then putting the entire fair housing law up to scrutiny. It will have to go back to HUD and go through an entire review process.
But do you
because
think,
you're making a substantive change.
Do you think
to
if
the law,
the, but you know, practically speaking, do you think if the only change we made was to make a penalty, reduce a penalty, but it was still more stringent than the federal law, HUD would likely have a problem with that?
Well, I think what you're saying, Mr. Chair, is that you submitted the law to us based upon this information. We reviewed the law, we created and granted substantial equivalency based upon what you submitted. Now you're going back and making additional changes which are substantive to the law. So now we have to go back and we will scrutinize, A, why you're doing it, what the reasons are, and it's going to be subject to it, and see whether or not it interferes with your substantial equivalency. That's all I'm saying.
Okay.
It's going to go back. What you might want to consider, and we may have a way of doing that, is that in that particular, since source of income is coming in as a separate category, if you may want to look at including the penalty under source of income, that might be one way that we can get around it, that just for that particular category, and I'm not sure that's going to apply.
Well, let me ask you this question. You raise an issue.
That is an issue, yes, sir.
The issue is, won't they look at the law anyway, since we're adding the source of income protection?
No, because they don't cover source of income. We're adding a category that they don't have.
Okay.
That they don't have. Right now, they're all laboring over including sexual orientation, so they haven't even gotten to the point of some source of income yet. They're right now dealing with sexual orientation. They don't cover source of income. If we add a category, that's fine with them, as long as it's not going to interfere with our substantial equivalency.
Let's say Burton has a question for you.
Jim. May I ask, if we were to include language that said that for purposes of this section only, the maximum penalty shall not exceed $50,000. Mm-hmm. Would you think that that would also trigger the review?
No, I'm saying that may be the only way that we could allow it to fly, because we are including a completely new category not covered by HUD.
All right. So that may be the way. When I received Mr. Maizano's memorandum over the weekend, and I may have been late getting my email, that seemed to be the 100,000 has always been something that's just a flashpoint, simply because I think it gets into six figures. And if we were to limit that 100,000 to 50, I think that might. It's a remedy that's never been invoked, right? You've never put out a fine for 100,000. And it seems like such a flashpoint to people that I'm not unsympathetic to doing that. And if that would be a satisfactory way of getting this in without triggering a full-blown review, I'd like to do that.
Well, I'm saying I think that we may be able
to. Right, and our attorneys would know how to put that language in.
You know, that for purposes of this section only.
Yes, for this income, the section only.
That may be the way that you are able to get in your minimized penalties without triggering a complete review by HUD.
Thank you for that information.
Great idea.
Mr. Chairman,
I mean, that in the spirit that it seems to be intended specifically for this particular item, if Mr. Maizano, who made this particular motion, would agree that we would be able to vote that particular thing out, because it would be to set the public hearing on this particular item, and I certainly would support that as well, you know, as far as that for this particular thing. Because I know that Mr. Bezzano doesn't like when we make modifications without having those modifications directly in front of us.
Oh, I would just say this. The reason that the sunset clause is something I talked to John and Ken about months ago as a compromise I thought that could kind of bring people together on this law. Now you answer Bill's question. But the thing I took from the last public hearing was so many of the people that are regulated by this law saying 100,000, 100,000. Now we broke it down and know that's really not 100,000 unless it's egregious conduct. We know the standards. But, you know, I'm going to go back to the point. I'm sorry if I'm repetitive. It's two meetings in a row. But I've never liked this open-ended civil penalty up to $50,000. That's why I made this change. Because, I'll say it again, folks, as an attorney who litigates cases where you deal with damages, as you do, John, we understand the concept of compensatory damages, right? You get back the amount that you get compensated for what you were damaged for. We understand punitive damages, when someone has some really bad conduct, when they've crossed lines, willful, wanton, things like that, right? We understand that. But this open-ended $50,000 the civil penalty, which as you described last meeting, is basically a bounty to the county. I've always been uncomfortable with that. And I could see why the people who are going to be regulated by this law were upset about the potential high penalties. And now we hear that's never even been invoked by the county. I think as a way to kind of really go further on compromise, to compromise to these people that are upset that they're going to be regulated by this law, maybe, and if we can come to a consensus to cap the damage to 50, I think that's a great change.
The question in my mind is whether we should do it for the whole fair housing law or just this one section.
Why don't we do it for this now, and then we can deal, since Dolores has now raised the issue, we got to go back to HUD on this huge thing.
Any comments on that proposal?
Well, if I may, just trying to understand, I thought from the last meeting it was up to 50,000 for essentially a violation, and it's up to 100,000 for the willful wanton. So now you're bringing the willful wanton, if I understand it, up to 50,000.
Yes.
But what about the just
there isn't
civil
penalty?
So there is so
no civil penalty. There would be no under legislative Maizano's proposal. There would be
unless it's willful.
His proposal?
Wait a minute.
It's right there.
Well, I'm not sure. Unless it's willful and wanton, there's no penalty at all.
Right. There's no civil penalty. There are damages that are available to the complainant, including punitive damages. And attorney's fees, but there's no, as we put it last time, there's no bounty for the county.
So the whole category of the up to 50,000 is repealed, is basically what you're saying. There was one category up to 50,000, and another category up to 100,000.
No, he's repealing the 100,000 and making the criteria for assessing the $50,000 penalty willful, wanton, or malicious.
Yeah, okay, well, so that... Okay,
that's
answers my question. But effectively, effectively repeals the $50,000
yes,
category.
Here's the bounty.
Which I like that change, folks. Yeah. I must tell you.
Ms. Grace-White, you've got to leave
yes,
the 130.
I want to
make a clarification
no
here purpose. That you're talking about specifically the source
yes.
of income
yes.
and not the fair housing law.
I think that's what Legislative Ms. Allen is proposing.
Because as it stands now, it's not to exceed 50. It is not to exceed 100. But if we're talking now about saying, as we do or have done earlier in the original human rights law, that punitive damage would be assessed up to 10,000, if you're going to say now up to 50,000 in terms of source of income only, and you're going to include that only in the source of income law, that's what I'm saying. That we may be able to get that to fly. I'm going to double check all of that, but I think that that's going to be the only way. But just want to make sure we're not looking at the law as it stands now, because that will be a major problem.
So understanding the panoply of penalties. At the one extreme, it's up to 50,000 willful wanton. If you're not in the willful wanton category, it's just what there's compensatory. So the respondent says, "I lost, I don't know, 2 months' housing. I get paid for 2 months' rent or whatever it
something
is,
something like that."
There are no legal fees because the commission is providing legal fees.
DENF. That's the damages and anything.
So, but punitive damages up to 10,000. So
right.
that's
to the complainant, not to the county.
That's to the complainant. It's okay. Punitive up to 10,000. But there's no attorney's fees because presumably they're representing.
Someone has the option of hiring.
They could
bring so if they have their own attorney,
much more reasonable.
Well, why should the housing go into the county at all? Why not just the other two categories?
Why do we need anything going to the county at all?
Well, the willful, in the willful wanton.
Well, I think the purpose of that is that if it serves, if someone is acting egregiously, they should be penalized further. Can I finish?
Sure.
You're not, and it's not something that the complainant is out. So if you're going to have a penalty, it's not going to go to the complainant because the complainant is not losing out. They haven't lost, they haven't had damage.
The second category is, isn't it?
That's compensatory damages, and there's a possibility for a complainant to get up to $10,000 in punitive. So there's nothing else to give to the complainant, so it would go
why is that
to the
more
county.
Than, more than $10,000 in punitive?
Fact,
I think I'll let
Ms. Braithwaite
answer. Look at the federal law and the city law. What they really look at is the damage to your community. What they're saying is when you have these kinds of issues of discrimination, it really is a damage to your county, to your city, to your municipality. And so consequently, they incorporated those additional penalties, which is why it's then paid to the municipality.
But okay. You're also going now with a whole new type of discrimination here. This is not the standard race.
I know, but this provision has been, this penalty provision has been discussed for the last 2 years. It's been in the proposed draft for 2 years.
That doesn't mean everybody's comfortable with it.
Well, but it means that we're not going to go revisit the whole concept of a civil penalty. Legislator Mazzano raised a good issue about the, you know, why we have the $100,000.
Okay, what's the difference between this and punitive? Because the
punitive damages goes to the complainant, the $50,000.
Right, but the standard is the same, right?
The standard is the same.
Pretty much the same.
It's
except
exactly
there
the
you
same.
Probably know it's
willful, wanton, or malicious. It's the same.
Willful, wanton, is it and malicious?
No, or malicious. Both
or
of the standards
malicious.
Are the
both
same.
Both of them are the same.
Exactly the same. Here it is. You see it?
So willful conduct.
Willful, wanton. I would like to take a look at that whole concept of willful conduct.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Right now
we
have
put that aside.
Legislators.
It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen.
We have legislators. It will if we put it on the agenda, which I will.
He's the chair.
But we have Legislator Mazzano's proposal.
I'd like to put it in the form of a motion, if I may.
Okay. Put it in the form of a very specific motion. Can you give him back his proposal?
Come so back my
we'll make sure he gets it right.
Can we change it to willful, wanton, and malicious?
No.
No, we can take a look at that issue separately, but for purposes of today, let's just deal with Legislator Mazzano's proposal.
My amendment would be that we place language into the source of income law that would state that the that re, now I was, they're going to have to add a little piece for me, the county attorney's office.
Yes.
Okay. So you'll have to give me the segue into this. But the segue into this is that we're modifying the civil penalty section of the Fair Housing Law for the purpose of the source of income law, and the way we would do that is assessing a civil penalty in an amount not to exceed $50,000 to be paid to the County of Westchester by a respondent found to have committed an unlawful discriminatory real estate practice which is found to be willful, wanton, or malicious.
I think, Jim, that we're saying, because Ms. Braithwaite made the point that we would only be modifying source of income.
Right. Yeah.
Therefore, we would say damages in...
The reason I'm feeling, well, I think we're just, maybe you didn't, maybe...
Yeah, you were talking about fair housing law, and I think
let
I
let me tell you why I think
simply.
We have to do it the way I said it. Maybe,
okay.
And if I'm wrong, you can tell me. I think that we have to make, because right now, we're following the penalties in this law, in the fair housing law.
In the fair housing
so
law.
If we're going to amend our law, we have to reflect that we're not following
right.
what's
so,
in that
so
law.
So why
that's
wouldn't
what I'm
we
saying.
Say nothing under, no penalty created under the source of income law shall exceed
$50,000? Yeah, that's fine. I mean,
why reference fair housing law at all?
Bill, if we could do it that way, that's just
now,
good.
It should be, if you look at Roman numeral 5, the whole entire source of income section of this law is under Roman numeral 5, section 3, Roman numeral 5, letter V. It goes V, W, X, Y, Z. So V, I think you just add a subdivision 5 that would say, for purposes of paragraph V of section blah, 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 the civil penalty shall apply as follows.
The way I just read it.
Right.
Yeah, so that's fine, Bill. I take, accept your friendly amendment.
There's a motion. Is there a second?
Let's see. We amended Jim's motion. I just amended Jim's motion, so I need a second for that.
How did you amend Jim's motion?
Because
I said we have to refer back to the
right.
Fair Housing Law. Bill said not to do
yeah.
that.
I mean, if you take that as a friendly amendment, eliminate the
all right, he accepted
yeah, I accept
amendment.
It, done.
All right,
now, so, I'll second Jim's motion.
Okay. Discussion.
Yeah, we were thinking, I mean, in this, in the penalty section of doing like an F-1 or something, you know, just, and we, you know, including for the purposes.
Well, then it would say for the purposes of 700, blah, 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 subdivision B, or paragraph.
Exactly.
Right. That works, too.
With respect to the real estate practices.
Fine. All right. Any other discussion? Yeah. Vote on the motion. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? None. Okay. So now we're up to, do I have a motion to vote the proposed source of income law with the amended sunset provision and the amended penalty provision to be set for public hearing?
Mr. Chairman,
and for all purposes.
We can't get a chart of this applies to government.
Could you prepare a chart of what you discussed earlier?
Yes.
Yeah, we'll get a chart.
Because I believe that there's still a misunderstanding.
All right. There's a motion by Legislator
second.
Williams, second by Legislator Markham. Quick discussion.
Yes.
Yes,
well,
Legislator Rogowski.
No one's made any comment about the recent California case and how that might apply, so that's one question. I'm still concerned. We got some testimony, talk about having a public hearing. We had a testimony. One gentleman specifically talked about rising insurance costs. I'm concerned that, you know, we really have no fiscal impact on what, whether it's to the government or to the affected industry. So I'm just concerned that no one's ever discussed, goes back to the whole need for the bill, but that's a separate issue. The committee report doesn't really, still doesn't set out the need for the bill, but fiscal impact, which was specifically addressed at the public hearing. You know, we have ETPA. Nowhere else in the country has ETPA. So in other places, or maybe there's one other place in the country, but most places where the fiscal impact to the landlord is satisfied, but the landlord says, well, I'll just raise around $50 over here there to cover whatever the impacts, whether it's insurance costs or repair costs. Landlords of Westchester County can't do that if it's an ETPA building. So we don't have a fiscal impact. The California case is just curious as to that, at least one level of courts rule that, at least as to existing tenants, it's illegal. Now it's in California. And third, to the issue, Mr. Chairman, you raised at the beginning, we don't have the answers relative to the sunset provision. Will this continue to apply to ETPA buildings? So we're voting something out, and we don't have those answers.
Okay, Legislator Harkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just on the issue of insurance, that was mentioned in a very cursory way in the public hearing. I don't think we should take that on fact, that someone stood up and just intimated that this law would require new insurance. He offered no proof, no policies, no proof whatsoever. This was an off-the-cuff remark by somebody in a public hearing. Now, if someone can bring us proof, then I'd be happy to look at that. But for us to go on the assumption that this is fact without any backup to this gentleman's remarks, I think would be detrimental to the process.
I think the person who made the remarks, though, was in the insurance industry, and he had a source of knowledge to it. What his knowledge was, I don't know, but I found him to be...
Has anybody here heard of source of income discrimination insurance? Is that a product that exists?
That's what he's talking about.
The legislature makes a fair point, but if to the extent that's the, you know, a line of thinking, then it would seem incumbent on this committee then to take testimony. We have a public hearing. Information came in. You may be right. It may have just been conjecture.
We have to have another public hearing.
I would have said it would have been incumbent upon him to provide the information.
Well, he came to the public and testified. If we're not prepared to take that, then this committee would think that needs to take that testimony. I mean, just my point. Whether the chairman's going to do it or not, but to follow your reasoning, it's a fair point. He raised it.
If he brings it, I'll read it.
We are having another public hearing, Marty.
Yeah.
We have to vote another public hearing.
I think there's an opportunity. Well, that's good. From my experience, and I know a little bit about insurance, most policies like that contain an exclusion for acts of discrimination. You might be able to buy that coverage now, so if they buy, the coverage will be available to buy, whether it's based on source of income or other discriminatory acts. But generally speaking, my recollection from most policies like this is that they exclude coverage for allegations of discrimination under federal or state statutes. And you might be able to buy a rider to get that insurance, which you would get anyway for discriminatory acts. And the California, I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, my point is, we had the public hearing. Gentleman made the point. Maybe we'll do it after the next public hearing. But if it's an open question, we're sitting conjecturing. We should take testimony in committee. That's the purpose of doing these things.
Well, but first time in 2 years that it's been raised.
Well, that's all the more reason.
Number two, thank you, to take testimony here before we pass the law. comes fairly close to bordering on filibustering.
He says the first time in 2 years.
Okay.
I think we all know where we stand on this.
Okay.
You made my point.
The California case is an intermediate appellate court case which interprets a section of California law which provided that, and by the way, California municipalities with their own source of income laws. This is a California state law that said source of income means lawful, verifiable income paid directly to a tenant or paid to a representative of a tenant. The court held, basically interpreting that law, not holding it unconstitutional or otherwise invalidating the law, but interpreting that provision to mean that a Section 8 payment doesn't go directly to the tenant, it goes from the housing authority or whoever administers a Section 8 to the landlord directly, and therefore Section 8 was not, actually there was a woman who was disabled, tenant, so whatever she was getting as rental assistance did not come within that statute because it was paid directly to the tenant. So that's it. I don't think the California law is, it's a different law, it's a different language, and it's not, you know, it's, you can consider it and look at it, but it's not really pertinent. By the way, that article points out that there are other jurisdictions that have rent control and the rent stabilized. Mm-hmm. We're not the only.
Which article?
The article about the California. Is this how you knew about it?
Yeah.
All right, so I think we've exhausted the discussion. We have a motion. Right. We'll take a vote.
I'm going to, on the motion.
Yeah.
I'm going to vote no.
Okay,
I'm still very
you.
Concerned about the applicability. And I think it's been very confused because of the negative and the exceptions. When you read the exceptions, the non-applicability of the entire housing law, it doesn't apply to a single-family home unless... No, it doesn't apply if the owner owns more than 3 single-family homes.
Right.
So this can apply to single-family homes if you own 4 single-family homes.
Yeah, it doesn't. Then you're out of the statute. Thank
you're
you.
Out of
we
the
all
statute.
Know that. You're not telling us anything that's not in the
I'm
plain language of the statute.
All right, but I just want to make it clear
Thank
on the
you.
Record why I'm voting no.
Okay.
Secondly, if you own 1 2-family home that you don't live in, it applies under
right.
the standard law.
Right.
And the exception that we've crafted here, which sounds like it's an addition, doesn't add anything. It's the same exception that is found in Section C1B. Of the law.
I disagree.
Well, it's under that section it says up to a 4-family home, owner occupied is exempt. So if it's not owner occupied, it could be a 2-family home and it's covered. Under this law, if the owner does not live in it and it's a 2-family home, it's covered. So that means a person who owns a 2-family house in which their mother or their daughter or whoever lives in that building, they now must take Section 8 if the appropriate person comes in.
They are covered by the
They are covered by the law. That's right. And
not
we're making mandatory
right.
what before was discretionary. And this is not for large landlords, as we're trying to give the impression. If somebody owns 1 2-family house, then they have to... Am I correct?
No. Only 1 2-family house?
Yeah, show me where it says.
And they live in the building?
No, they don't live in the building.
If they live in a house and own a separate 2-family house.
Yes.
Yes.
That separate 2-family house, if that's the only other building they own, is exempt from.
Where does it say that?
That's
Tom, I'm going to call for a vote because I think
I'm trying to see. I think there's a misinterpretation.
But you've had a year and a half to read this and come up with this. So I want to
call
for a
vote. John, I've been saying this all
along. I'm
going to
call for a vote. I'm calling for a vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Oh no.
No.
Three no's.
Okay.
This is for all purposes. Right?
Yes. Thank you. And we can carry on this discussion, but, you know...
But I don't want a misinterpretation to the world out there that 2-family houses are exempt. They're not.
No one said that.
Okay, so...
You can read the statute, and it's clear.
It's ownership, not the kind of building.
I understand that. So if you own 1 2-family house and you don't live in it, it's covered.
No.
Yes, that's the whole... I want somebody to show me in the language where it is.
You're right. You're right.
It'd be just
up. We all
it is covered.
It is covered, if you don't live in it.
Thank you.
But if you own another 2-family house that you live in, and then you own that 2-family house, it is
not covered.
All right, we're going to move on. We're going to move on to. Don't leave. You're up there. You're up on the hot seat. Oh, oh, I'm sorry. Linda's got that one.
Mr. Chairman, the clarity is that we got opinion from the county attorney's office. If you are voting no, you do not sign the piece of paper.
Because you're each owner-occupied, the owner
No, don't sign it.
Okay. Ms. Braithwaite, Dolores, thank you for coming.
We have the county attorney's opinion. We're allowed a minority report underneath the, so there's a minority report of three people voting no. You can have a minority report. But you don't sign that. You can have a minority report, but you do not sign that piece of legislation.
You don't sign with a no?
No. That's what the county attorney is upon.
Without switching, where's the seat?
It's crazy. 20 years. I actually didn't come under my term, so I'd like
to
see that.
I bet you it says that you don't need to sign.
Chief of Staff Oros would like to make a comment.
I used to not sign if I voted no. And so we got out on the floor, and I added up the signatures, and we said there were, we made a big point out of there not being enough people signing it out because it didn't look like there was a quorum. The legislation got rejected. Marty then later looked at the minutes of the meeting and found out there was a quorum, but I had voted no. That was the reason we started putting the no vote there.
Correct.
Right. And I think the point was very much to not confuse the original quorum, which permitted the meeting to go on for a vote, with the issue of how many people were present at the time that the vote was conducted.
But sometimes you can have a quorum for a meeting, but not you need more for a vote in some committee.
Right. Yeah.
I'm not a legislator anymore.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, the next topic, eminent domain.
How it came about.
Eminent domain. We have three, we left open three issues last week to discuss this week. One is the issue of whether the proposed legislation is preempted by state law. And that's why I've asked the county attorney to be here and discuss two. I have two opinions, one from 2006 and one from 2005. Second issue is to discuss the definition of public use and whether we want to make any changes to that. And then the third issue, which was raised in the first meeting, which we haven't fully resolved, is whether the legislation should have a private cause of action. Are there any other issues? That's enough. Good point. Okay, so on the issue of preemption, anyone have any questions, discussions about the opinions? Actually, there's another aspect we have to discuss of the opinions, and that is the opinion that there would be, the law would require a mandatory referendum.
All right.
And there is an opinion that should be forthcoming from the county attorney's office.
Do you know what that opinion, is that opinion going to change the opinions?
I think a lot of what is there, it still goes over the issue of certain matters being preempted by state law, for sure. Not necessarily an entire document, but there are provisions there to the extent that they would interfere, or I can go over some of that with you here today.
Okay.
To the extent that it is not preempted by law, that you were correct in saying that the mandatory referendum would be necessary for certain provisions. And the issue of this one dealt with the issue also of private right of action. There's some concerns in connection with that, some issues that we can go over. What we started doing is just going over section by section in connection with those.
My question on preemption is that the eminent domain procedure law seems to set forth a procedure for condemnation of property by government entities. It doesn't seem to regulate the criteria you would use to make the decision to exercise eminent domain. So
it does leave a lot of issue open-ended. What I always thought was interesting is that if you look in those 204 provisions of the eminent domain law, which requires the legislative body establish certain findings and determinations, it would seem to me that that would be the best place for the board to focus on instead of for excuse me, what it deems to be important to establish those findings and determinations.
It also looks like the prior, one of the prior opinions at least discussed a broader proposal that dealt with paying a property owner 150%. Could you go through the current draft that we have and tell us, you know, based upon to the extent you can now, what you think the opinion we're waiting for is likely to say?
Okay. Well, the first section is just a short title. The second section deals with the public uses.
Yeah.
Again, this section, I think you should try to make sure you're mirroring and not contravening the language in the 204B of the eminent domain law, because that specifically requires that the determinations and findings by the legislature should include the public use, benefit, or purpose to be served by the public project, the approximate location for the proposed public project and the reasons for the selection of that particular location, the general effect of the proposed project on the environment and the residents of the locality, and such other factors as it deems relevant, which is where I think the board can expand upon what the things are.
So basically our definition of public use could fall within that last catch-all provision.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
And remember why, just for everyone's purposes here, the reason we wrote public use this way was what we did, Tom and I, was, you know, after Kelo, a bunch of states changed their state law relating to public use because those states, sadly New York did not do this, felt that taking private property for private use for shopping malls and co-ops and condos, like Kelo, was not a public use. And they wanted to define it better in their state laws. So Tom and I took a look at a lot of those laws that are opposed around the country, and that's where we came up with this language. I say that because we're not locked into this language. This is what Tom and I thought would do what we wanted, but if other people have changes, whether it's county attorney's office or colleagues, we're open.
Okay, you want to go through then the next section, the eminent domain for private use prohibited?
Well, there was one other part. In the third section, there was a little bit of concern of the definition with respect to Westchester County government.
Yeah.
Because if you look in the manner by which the term Westchester County government is utilized in the text of the legislation, it's somewhat inconsistent. For example, it says Westchester County government may use powers of eminent domain to condemn private property, but the actual way that you defined it, it would include like a legislator.
Well, they could clean that up, John. I don't care. They feel like they got to clean it up. Let them clean it up.
There's some clean.
Let them.
How would you clean it up? You define the government as the legislature?
Well, you would have to make a distinction between what you're talking about. When it's the legislature as a whole that's working, and when you want individual.
Oh, so maybe you, instead of saying Westchester County government is hereby prohibited, you'd say the Board of Legislators is hereby.
It depends on how you want to utilize that. Right.
Mm-hmm. I understand. And by the way, John, I don't know. I frankly don't remember, but I think it's true that the county's attorney's office has never gone through our proposed law and made it their version of a county law.
That's correct. We've never been asked to do something.
No, actually, you were. Attorney was asked on multiple occasions, your prior boss, and did not do it with something, which I'm very happy we have a new county attorney. But nevertheless, I had asked many times. Matter of fact, I have emails that reflect, can you please take this law and put it into a county law version? And it never happened. I mean, it mysteriously never showed up here that way.
Okay, so one thing you would do is, if you had, and I guess we're requesting you to take a look at this and make any changes you think are necessary to not that it not be preempted or that it be made clearer.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that would include numbers, subdivisions 1 and 2. Okay, anything else? As far as what issues you see are raised with respect to preemption or otherwise?
Again, in Section 4, I just want to clarify what the findings are, that the findings do have to be consistent with those findings that are required by the EPTL. Yeah.
Okay.
In connection with
To back up for a second, maybe we should add a provision then that says this law is not intended to abrogate, you know, it's supplementary.
Yes, good. Okay. Like that. Good, I got you smart people around me today.
We're being very accommodating.
I'm working on this law for 6 years. We're getting close.
Okay,
I'm accommodating, believe me.
Go ahead.
Well, the two-thirds vote would obviously also is another reason why a mandatory referendum would be required.
Does anybody disagree a mandatory
referendum? No, it sounds like we need one.
Yeah, well, because not only because of the diminution of powers of the Board of Legislators.
Right. It curtails the powers of the
legislature. It requires
a majority. Right. But also in connection with the municipal home rule specifically relates to the power of condemnation.
I have no problem. As I told you before, Mr. Chair, this will pass overwhelmingly in a mandatory referendum. Seen the polling on it.
Could you
okay, what about any other? I mean, I think the private right of action ought to be deleted. That's my opinion.
There are many concerns with the private right of action in a couple of ways. First of all, the private right of action seems to be inconsistent between who had the authority to bring a private right of action and then who had the enforcement ability. So I wasn't sure if you wanted them to be two separate things or not, but in any way, I think those would have to be clarified a little bit. To the extent that also the private right of action also seemed to indicate that there could be some injunctive relief. To the extent that that injunctive relief would in any way impair the procedures involved in connecting with eminent domain, that would be preempted. So it wasn't really clear what sort of action was required.
Yeah, I also think that you don't need a private right of action because if a condemnee would be a party to the proceeding and could assert the violation of this law as a defense to condemnation.
That's in there because I was accommodating 6 years ago when Tom wanted to put that in.
All right, well, he's not here, but it seemed to me that someone whose property is being condemned is a party to a condemnation proceeding under the eminent domain procedure law, and they could assert this as a defense.
And that would arguably be improper because it's, again, affecting the eminent domain procedures and interfering with that.
I think we should take that out.
I mean, I'm inclined to take it out, too. I would like to give Tom his say, but he's not here right now.
I'm sure he'll tell us next time whether he disagrees with it or not.
Why don't we take it out for now?
After we pass it,
take it out for now.
And what about the enforcement is tied into the private?
Well, you have to cut that. You have to take that out.
Yeah.
Excuse me?
Off the record. Off the top.
Okay.
The other concern was in the definition relating to affordable housing and the impact that would have on the ADC, whether or not that would impact on the ADC settlement, because we are limiting something that we've indicated that is currently available to us in connection with affordable housing projects. So there's a possibility that it could be viewed in that way.
Do you think the affordable housing section is troublesome?
The chair had asked if we could if there would be a problem if we removed that exemption, and because the ADC settlement says basically that we'd be using any and all available reasonable means.
So you think we should leave it in?
But
at least it's subject to a two-thirds vote.
But you also indicated in the affordable housing, you're eliminating affordable housing by private developers. And to the extent that you're completely eliminating a potential avenue as to where you could get affordable housing, that would arguably be a reduction of...
Right, so you're suggesting we leave this in.
But with modification.
With modification.
What modification?
Because
what we did was, I'll just tell you this, just let me, so that everyone knows, I remember when we did this. We were trying to make a distinction of the not-for-profit affordable housing developers and the for-profit ones. And that's why we did it that way. And 6 years ago, that seemed like a good thing to do. I'm open-minded on potential.
So, in other words, now it restricts the affordable housing to a government agency or a not-for-profit.
Yes.
Right. And we think that restriction would likely have to come out because of the terms of the ADC settlement.
So it would just be a blanket exemption for affordable housing.
Yeah.
Or fair and affordable housing.
But no, that Mr. Chairman, if I can jump in. Now we're back to the Kelo situation. The idea here was to prevent a private housing developer from coming in and saying, hey, we're going to give you, 20 units out of 1,000 units of affordable housing, therefore we qualify.
Well, to answer your question better than you just did. When we're exempting affordable housing, the question is, and I actually...
Arguing against this issue.
If affordable housing is one piece of an overall bigger development, is that exempted out, or is only pure affordable housing exempted out?
Well, I think.
Well, you'd have to say.
I think the way the exemption is currently crafted, it would be just pure affordable housing.
Well, then I think we could be okay with that. Tom's point was, like, Kelo may have had, like, one piece of it affordable, you know what I mean? And the rest was
a token piece.
Yeah, so yeah. That yeah. Can't, that we wouldn't want that, but if it's pure affordable housing development, ADC-like, I could make that change.
Well, there was some discussion that we should take this out completely and not make an exemption. Well,
they're saying the opposite.
Before you came in, they took a position that we might be barred by the ADC settlement.
In paragraph 7 of the ADC settlement, 7I, it says the county shall use all available means as appropriate to achieve the objectives set forth in this paragraph, including but not limited to developing financial or other incentives for other entities to take steps to promote objectives of this paragraph and conditioning or withholding the provision of county funds on actions that promote the objectives of this paragraph.
Look, my view, Tom, is this. We've worked long and hard on this law. We're starting to get a consensus where I think colleagues will support it. Last thing I want to do is have this law get caught up in the ADC battle. That's just a bigger, badder fight out there. If we can do this so that ADC does its thing and our law does its separate thing in a different way, I think that's the road we go down.
Well, how do we narrow this down to make it clear that it applies only to the housing portion?
Why don't we let the county attorneys take a crack at that and come back to us?
Like, there's a provision in the right of first refusal. When we put that exemption, it's something like substantially for affordable housing, something like that.
Let them take a crack at it. They'll bring it back the next meeting. I'm not voting on it today. Let them come back with a proposal. We'll take a look at it.
Now, do you have anything else, Linda or Justin?
And now you're going to take our law and make it a county version. Clean it up, right? And you're actually going to come back, right, with it?
That could be 6 years.
Yeah, I'm not going to wait 6 years
six
now.
Years.
the only last thing that we had was, again, with respect to the effective date.
I may be changing employment soon. I need you to work quickly.
Mr. Chairman, on that point,
sure.
Before we go further, can we somehow make it clear that the county's got to be involved in this? Because you want to craft an exemption for the affordable housing that we're talking about here. We don't want to open the door up so that any developer can come in and just, because otherwise if you wipe the exemption, wipes out the whole statute.
This is a county law. It's always going to be the county involved.
No, not necessarily.
Well, what do you mean by the county involved?
I'll give you an example. If Austin, for example, builds a redevelops a waterfront, Austin is not under the ADC 7.
Right.
Austin proposes, has a 10% rule, I think it is. So a 125-unit project is developed where 15 units are going to be affordable. And for reasons that are completely lost on me, the developer is not taking any money from anybody else. It's just the set-aside that the village demands. There is no county involvement in this, short of just the review of the plan by the county planning department. Therefore, if the village of Austin condemns property under the eminent domain law for the purposes of redeveloping its waterfront, and has this
for that developer.
Right. Are you, well, for its own purposes, using the developer, this is where you and I have a distinction in this matter, would this law apply or would it not?
No, because this is only controlling county government activities.
County funds.
We're not governing outside. So now the question is, if they came to us and wanted some money, then the law would be triggered.
Right. Now, Austin took CDBG money.
No, money has to be for the project only.
CDBG money was used for that project utilities and sidewalks and parking.
I don't think that would be county money.
It doesn't cover because it's not county money. It's federal money that came through the county, but it's not federal.
Well, no, it could possibly be triggered in that situation.
Well, he raises a good question, my friend, Legislator Burton, and you can add another piece to that because we haven't really discussed it, but people have discussed it to ask me about it, is has this affect IDA interactions? And I don't think it can.
We discussed this at last week.
Yeah, but I don't think it can, right?
Yeah, actually did a section on that, too. Pursuant to New York State General Municipal Law, the ID section 856, subdivision 2, Westchester County IDA is a separate form of governmental entity.
Is this one of your prior opinions?
No, this is one coming. You asked.
This is the forthcoming opinion that we haven't gotten yet. Okay. So that'll come, that opinion, with the redraft of the law. All right?
It's just a brief thing that notes that it's a public benefit corporation, so it's not under the office.
Yes.
Well, I like laws being clear, so not to play this what if. I don't like throwing hypotheticals, but this was, I mean, I think CDBG is an important issue. So if we don't have a good answer, I think there should be, and I can argue with you, it's federal funds, but
can you look into that?
There should be a clear answer. That's a good point.
When you make your changes, you make it clear that community owned block grants aren't included.
So let me throw out another example. I don't like doing this, but right now I'll be bringing an issue to the board because Portchester, locality condemned, built this project. In order to make the deal worth, some of you were here then, the county rented for 20 years, paying lease payments of $800,000 a year into the project, to a developer, basically. In order to make that development work, they were short money. Those of you here, now there's problems with the project, but the promenade's falling apart. But there's $800,000. Now, it's not a grant, but it's county. It's a part of the county is renting. Quid pro quo, we're getting access to the promenade, but in that case, could the county make that deal if, in fact, there was Portchester condemnation involved? Would the county have been able to enter into that lease?
No. as this is now drafted,
I think no.
It's not a grant.
The county government is hereby prohibited from in any way contributing funds from any source or other support to any project.
So it's not just a contribution grant. You're getting value for
funds or anything else.
Or other support.
Or anything else. Right. So even though you're getting value.
That project and what you're seeing happening there now in the newspaper is, once again, a motivation for this legislation.
No, that's not motivated. I mean, the village decided to condemn. They did the project's built. Everything is going along okay, I think. But part of the puzzle back at the beginning, instead of telling the developer, you don't have enough money, bring in a partner, well, was it went to the came to the county. And the county, in a sense, became the partner
by the way,
renting the promenade. So okay. There's other issues.
An analysis of whether we ever got paid back on.
Well, that's another question.
But to the point of this legislation,
those lease payments would then disqualify.
Yes.
So if the village hadn't already condemned, they would have been disqualified. They had, the county would not be able to enter that lease.
Yes.
Okay. I just wanted to.
That was part of one of my votes
I wish I could take back in my career.
I'm open to discussion on whether I should have not voted that way. I'm very troubled by
that. Someone says, pass me, to follow up Marty and Bill's question, someone pass me a third one, we just say before they go back and do their edits. Under Mr. Burton's first example, if the village of Ossining abated taxes in the private project, if they abated the county taxes, does that demonstrate county funds, or constitute county funds? Mm-hmm. Interesting question.
It's support. It's other support.
We would abate...
How do you abate taxes through a pilot?
All right, so the pilot would cover all taxes. It would cover county taxes, town taxes, special district.
So if the local government abated
all of them,
yeah.
Would that be a contribution?
It's support.
I can't say how it can't.
It's support. Sure.
Yeah. Okay.
I did have a concern in connection with this as well because there's no location or project limitation in connection with that. Do you want to leave it open-ended in connection with any projects? Because here's for an example. Say, would the county be prohibited from contributing to a not-for-profit organization that is currently a tenant in a location that had been acquired by eminent domain, say, 20 years ago?
No. The eminent domain has taken place. We can't go back. We're talking about going forward.
Don't you think it says that? If not, you can play with it.
I think even going forward.
Are you saying renewing the lease would be a problem?
Well, if I can, on that point, Mr. Chairman, because I'm living through Portchester, there's a land acquisition agreement. There was condemnation 5 years ago.
Right.
There's a possibility of condemnation next year. It's a living process. The developer has a window of 10 or 15 years. So you could argue it took place 6 years ago, but they have right next year. So it's a long project, so I think it's a relevant point.
Well, it is interesting.
It's not historic, and it's the same project, basically. So.
Right. You know, I think everybody missed my point before on this thing that I read. It's a question that's a little different than I think the reaction from people. Let me just say it again. Right? The village of Ossining does a pilot with local developer, and the eminent domain is used, and in that pilot, they abated property taxes for 10 years, which include county, city, state, school, the whole thing. Right?
Your show did that. Right?
New Rochelle did it. New Rochelle did it with
The Avalon, right?
The Avalon building. It's a 40-year tax abatement. They don't pay any property taxes.
What do we get for that?
We can have a long chat later. But it's actually one of the things, aside, Mr. Legislature Chair was looking for new issues, that's always been so troubling to me, right? These local governments can make deals with developers and take away our county tax dollars.
That's correct.
It's always been a troubling thing to me since the day I got here.
Keep our sales tax too.
From the local level, Jim, that's a terrific thing.
I know. You're here now. You're no longer the supervisor.
It's a terrible thing.
The other thing...
Well, that's a result of the fact that they levy the taxes rather than us.
I know, but something we might want to look at as a committee someday. If any way the county could put a whole...
They collect the tax. We'll put it on the agenda.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, Mr. Chairman, this does address that partially. If you want to interpret this broadly.
Yeah.
I think it's subject to broad interpretation. one of the provisions we decided before you walked in, we discussed and decided to take out, which I think you had proposed, was the private right of action.
We did take it.
Yeah, and I think that...
I would like to argue in favor.
I don't like that.
We'll give you a chance, that's why. But I would say, just before you argue in favor of it, I think that violation of this law would be a defense in a condemnation proceeding that a condemnee could raise. So they would have an ability to use this law to oppose a condemnation without having to bring a lawsuit. They would be, the condemnee, the person whose property is being condemned, would be a party in the proceeding under the eminent domain procedure law and can assert the violation of this law as a defense.
Can we put that language in? Instead of the right of action.
We have the jurisdiction for that?
We don't want to bring ourselves in a party with every condemnation proceeding that comes in.
No, not the Westchester County, which is what Tom is suggesting.
Some kind of a defense.
You have a specific provision that says that. How do you define it?
You see, this is not.
Wait. A person who owns property that is the subject of an eminent domain condemnation proceeding may assert the violation of this law as a defense.
But, John, this is not intended. This is not intended to deal with the condemnation. This is intended to enforce the law. This is very, very different.
If a later county government, none of us are here because we'd all do the right thing, if a subsequent county government didn't follow this law, the person would have a private right of action based on that county government.
And it would not affect the condemnation at all.
But wouldn't they have that anyway?
No, because that only with respect to the condemnation. What happens if the county executive somehow on his own decides to grant some monies, which he gets from wherever, to some project in violation of this, and it never comes through the Board of Legislators?
We just forget that the law exists and go ahead and do it because we forgot the law.
I mean, the board could sue.
Is what you're saying.
Right. But the board
start out with this. The conservative part of me says we shouldn't start creating private causes of action.
But we do it elsewhere in our charter. This is not brand new. I picked this up.
Maybe
we
ought to look at eliminating some of them then.
Well, let's go forward here for a second. There are monies that the county executive has access to that never come to the Board of Legislators. We only spend monies that require agreements or that require appropriations from us. But there are other monies that somehow go through Board of A&C. No, I think ANC reform should. I can't tell you which ones right now, but I've seen it happen in the past. I've yelled about it.
Friends of Parks.
Whatever, wherever the monies come through, there are monies that go through ANC that we've never touched.
Who thinks does anyone else agree we should have a private?
Well, let me just finish the argument. The point I'm making is now the county executive somehow contributes to a project unwittingly or intentionally, and says let them stop me. And now
the
next door
in Pelham, Mount Vernon border.
Exactly.
And you sue.
See Maysano v. Spano in the appellate division. Which we won. They lost.
And
nothing personal.
Nothing personal.
But the point here is, this is allowing interested parties not to affect the condemnation.
Great case.
But to enforce the county law. Because it may only be a $100,000 contribution to $1 million private or multi-million-dollar contract.
But remember why Maysano...
Our
case says...
But that's only where the legislature...
One legislator can sue to stop an illegal action by the county executive. That's what that Maysano v. Spano says. One legislator could... The county attorney's office said you needed a majority. I don't know where they got that opinion from. One legislator could do it.
It's the county version of Silver v. Pataki.
Yes, it is. That's
on
right.
On the procedural issue.
Did you get attorney's fees, though?
But
no,
here,
I should have asked for it. None of,
here,
I thought I looked greedy.
The point is, this is a mechanism to enforce our law, not to affect the condemnation.
Tom has made his argument. Anybody agree we should leave the private cause of action in?
Well, on that, if we were to follow that logic, one could argue that we could put a private cause of action in a whole bunch of laws.
Yes.
Yeah,
you're just saying...
Yes.
Can I ask a question? So where do you draw the line? Okay, as long as I understand what you're saying.
I'm sorry. You know,
so I'm saying, once you open that door, the argument is, well, then why aren't we putting in just...
That's my question.
Sure.
I have a great question.
Yeah.
Can you explain, if you can, off the top of your heads, I know, right now, Citizen X, the Mastanovich Spano situation, right? Seriously, so the citizen saw that the county attorney, they think the county executive did an illegal action, right? Now, in our case, you know, we sued as legislators and the Pelham communities did. But what, can a citizen bring that kind of action? Is there anything in state?
There's certain taxpayer lawsuits.
Yeah, that's my question.
Also, some states have implied.
That's why I'm wondering if there already is a private right of action on a taxpayer lawsuit.
There's questions of who has standing to bring.
Yeah,
that.
Right.
That's correct. Yeah. Right. We're giving standing on everything.
Who has standing?
No, we're giving standing to a very narrow group of people here, though. So the two people affected. The guy who owns the property to which there's an illegal contribution of county money, and number two, somebody within 1,000 feet. And so you're really just narrowing. It's almost similar to a zoning board of appeals situation where you give standing to those interested parties in the neighborhood.
I'm wondering, Tom, when there's a taxpayer lawsuit,
when there's a taxpayer lawsuit, you've got to have certain other requirements that you have to meet. Huh? You've
got
to be different than all taxpayers.
It may be an implied cause of action. I don't by an agreed party. Can you look into that?
Well, what's wrong with this concept, though?
It's not that straightforward a question, actually. Mm.
It's an interesting question.
But, John, what was the sense as to why there's a problem with this?
Because I don't like creating, personally, I don't like creating private causes of action in every statute. You wind up with...
Well, what's the remedy if this is done?
Jim Misano or some forward-looking...
Misano v. Astorino will be coming.
Right.
That will be the day.
Or I'll be the judge.
A. Williams versus Astorino.
Yeah, I may have to recuse myself.
Or Misano as
At any rate, so I think that there are certain statutes, something like this, where it can happen outside of the Board of Legislators, particularly where you're so affecting a community.
Well, it is narrow. It's narrowly tailored to the people that are affected. So
directly affected.
What do you want to do? Do you want to leave it in for now?
Your only right to challenge the county contribution.
What does everybody want to do?
I would say leave it in for a while.
What does everyone else think? I'm open-minded, so I'd rather listen to my colleagues. Marty, what do you think?
I'm not for this law.
Doesn't matter. But you just want this issue.
Is he my friend? Should I go with it? Should I go with him on this one?
What do you think, Peter?
As a matter of principle, I'm concerned.
Out.
I might have to be against it. The
majority says out, Tom. Go with the majority. We're trying to pass a law here. Working together.
I'm going to raise two other things about two other things.
Trying to get a majority here, Tom. Be nice to everybody.
Two other points. I think everybody's aware. There's a pending state... statute being considered.
Actually, there are approximately 18 pieces of
18, but I'm looking at the one that's sponsored by
Senate.
The one sponsored by Perkins that would change the definition of blight.
And Legislative Poland has that same bill, right?
Or a version of it.
Yeah.
We're attempting to.
Tom and I advised her on that one.
Well, I think the question we might have to eventually face, maybe not now, is whether any of these laws would preempt what we're doing here. Other point I want to
make. John, we're not controlling anybody but ourselves. So we can't be preempted. We have a right to set up our own procedures.
There's lots of laws we enact for Westchester that are preempted.
Those are Westchester-wide. This is controlling the actions of county government and only county government. This probably will require a referendum.
It will.
We're changing the balance of who can do what in the county government. But outside of that, there should be no, because we're not affecting anything
statute said no county government could restrict its powers of eminent domain in any way whatsoever. Would you say we're preempted?
I think you have a very interesting challenge between whether they have the right to do that, because it might be a constitutional violation. Because we have certain powers. We've got a county charter.
Yeah, but we're limited. We don't have
No, we're a charter county. We've got more power than we sometimes think.
Exactly.
It's a charter county, you do, right. Final point, question I wanted to raise is, we left this open last week based upon the testimony we heard. You know, we heard testimony both for and against this law, but the two lawyers who testified...
Lawyers whose clients sent them here? Want to put that on the record? They were here with billable hours on behalf of their clients?
We don't have proof they built it. But they did raise an issue as to whether we should
draw upon Justice Kennedy's opinion in the Kelo case in adding or tweaking the definition of public use. And, you know, there was some interesting, these are the seven criteria, and I'll just read them out, and if anybody gets, is inspired by them and thinks we ought to include any or all of them, I don't think we should include all of them, but we might want to consider whether any of these are worth adapting to our proposed statute. Pre-existing determination that a distress...
I'm sorry, John, before you read them, what is Kennedy offering these for? The purpose of what?
As a criteria for when property could be condemned for not a pure public use, not for
we,
a
we
road
avoid
or
that
a
issue.
The old-fashioned public.
We avoid that.
No, because you have a definition of public use.
Yeah, but we don't agree with that holding. That's why we're doing this law.
I know, but he set forth criteria.
Right, but I think he, yeah, he wrote the opinion. And I thought he was wrong. That's why we did this law.
Well, with the result, but maybe some of these issues are...
Should have wrote the law?
Yeah, this... I
what is Kennedy, concurrence?
This is either concurrence or the dissent. Hold on, let me just... give me 1 second to check that.
He was in the majority.
I thought he was the swing vote.
He was.
Well,
maybe he didn't write
the
opinion.
He wrote
it was a concurring opinion. It's a concurring opinion.
Okay.
So he didn't write the majority, but he wrote a concurring opinion. And I guess he found that that project satisfied these criteria. All right. So that's why he concurred. He didn't agree with the broader proposition in the majority opinion. Pre-existing determination that a distress condition exists. I don't think he would buy that. You two drafters. The formulation of a comprehensive development plan meant to address that condition. A substantial commitment of public funds to the project before most of the private beneficiaries are known. I'm not suggesting, I'm just throwing this
no,
out.
I hate them so far, keep going.
Interested in any of these. The condemnor's review of a variety of development plans. The condemnor's choice of a private developer from a group of applicants rather than picking out a particular developer beforehand. The identities of most of the private beneficiaries being unknown at the time the condemnor formulated its plan. And seven, the condemnor's compliance with elaborate procedural requirements that facilitate the review of the record and inquiry into its purposes. I don't know, I'm not moved by a lot of those.
I second that.
Can I make a suggestion here, John? What we're trying to do here is we're not getting involved in the local when condemnation is right or wrong. We're setting a public policy of when it's important enough for the county to be involved. And that's a little different issue.
I mean, no, you're defining public use. You're right. Saying,
but from the point of
only from the county,
only from the county,
yeah, only when the county uses eminent domain, and when the county wants to spend its
right.
tax dollars.
No, the second part that's really driving
spending tax dollars.
Right, because right. we never use eminent domain.
Well, exactly, but for participation, in county dollars or permissions, as it were.
That's the big issue.
It seems to me that the fundamental distinction that it's why I'm opposed to this measure. Is that by limiting the home rule abilities of municipalities to, in their best judgment, and in the case of my village anyway, subject every year to election changing the composition of the board in a substantial way, at least 40% of the members would be subject to being pulled out if the public were really opposed to this, you make it impossible for a board to exercise its decision-making process in one of these major undertakings, in this case a waterfront redevelopment, but elsewhere.
Why do you say that?
Because if the county...
They can do whatever. They can do everything they always do. They just can't have county money infused into
yes,
it.
Yes, but that's what you're doing. You're well, stopping us.
Yeah, I was saying...
We've discussed...
We will not be your partner
right, no,
if you go down this road.
Right. You will stop this project because... County participation is deemed by the local community.
Not necessarily true. Maybe they didn't really need to do eminent domain.
Well, that may be. But leaving that aside, because we discussed this with Mike Zarin last week, Mike had been the attorney for the village of Boston when this was undertaken. We agreed that the village wiped out a business. It had no place to go. Its only property was the one that it had there, and they went out of business as a consequence of this. Exactly what was... So horrendous, and I think many people believe, and I'm not necessarily opposed to the interpretation of what happened in Borchester, that this was a decision by the local municipality, and I come down much more strongly on the side of home rule than I think I may have ever thought that I would. But in this instance, I particularly find it to be very unwise for the county to be taking a position which interferes with the decision-making process of the local municipality. And this law is doing that, and that's why I'm opposed to it.
So interesting to think that way, because I think this law doesn't do that. I think it has nothing to do with the home rule. They can make their own decision. They can do whatever they want. This law doesn't affect home rule one iota. It basically, that every decision-making process and the home rule process is preserved 100%. The only thing that changes is that developer can't come to the county to get money infused into his project. What has that got to do with home rule?
Nothing. That developer, that municipality could also come.
Yeah, the other way.
Right.
Anybody else want to that debate? That's interesting.
But it's very, I mean, I don't know how you could use the term home rule in that. You could say that you don't like the fact the county will partner with them in the future.
Which one are you helping?
Well, I'm helping you by helping him.
Oh, I see.
Because,
okay.
Because I think Bill's point, it's much larger. You're right. The developer doesn't come to the county, but it's a redevelopment, if you will, of that area of the town. So the village or whatever municipality takes a broader viewpoint. And the village might say, we need to condemn a piece of property over there. The developer there is going to do its own thing and doesn't need any county money. But as part of the overall project, we need to do something there. So to his point, it does
home rule preserved. Exactly. Home rule preserved 100%.
Says because we have a lot of little villages, they effectively, on paper you may be right, effectively they can't do without help from somewhere else. Maybe they get the state to come in, but to the extent they look for the county, as all of our municipalities look for us to come in, because they can't do it
that part's
else.
True, but I don't think that they need to do home rule.
So you're looking at the law and says, no, it doesn't affect home rule on paper, but in reality, that municipality really can't do everything it wants to do without the assistance.
And I don't know if that's ever true. As far as I'm concerned, all of these projects
are
done without
eminent domain. They seem to come to the county all the time.
It's
hogwash.
It's a way to manipulate the law to steal people's property.
And what if it's going the other way? If the inspiration's coming from the county or the... where the local government says, you know, it's going to be too hot for us to do this, the county government should condemn it.
I don't know.
It hasn't happened
right
yet.
Mind would ever undertake that line of logic.
Well, I don't know about that.
Well, you show me one in history and then we can discuss it.
Well, I think we have the county attorney ready to go to another draft here. Okay.
Well,
we have more debate to come.
Mr. Chairman, one other issue. Yeah. I'd like to have this defined. Under public use, our concept was the easy one, the first one. The one that everybody agrees with, but I think it needs better language because somebody asked what does public agencies mean. The concept was that if we were going to be, you know, building a police
what
station.
You're talking about subdivision
one.
Right.
The definition of public use. The concept was if we needed to condemn some land to put in a police department, that's not necessarily occupation by the general public.
Right.
It's occupation by a public entity, right. Public agency. I don't know that the word public agency needs definition, but somebody asked that question last time. So the concept was, you know, whatever we see is the Department of Public Works needs to go there, or it's a park. So how do you define that term?
Tom, you could say, county agency.
Mr. Chair, rather than do this right now, I think that we've kind of come to a
place. I want the county attorney at this point. There's a time frame.
Can I talk? I think the best thing to do at this point, we've discussed a lot here, very good points by everyone. Legislative Abbott and I will talk to the county attorneys, talk about the vision behind our language here. We can work with them on the amendments the next round, and another document come back, we can have a further debate.
Right. There is a
I don't think we need
issue.
To do it here
it
now.
It is a timing issue. If you would like to do this year, it has to be done in time to have a public referendum.
90 days from Election Day.
So
we're still in that window.
The timetable for that, like you did in the 2006 memo, has the timetable.
And Tom and I could reach out to you this week, and we'll talk about some of these issues.
I think it's going to be July sometime. Right?
Mm-hmm. Well, last time was August 5th, wasn't it? But we have to have a public hearing on it. Yeah,
Election day is November 2nd. Election day is November 2nd.
I know.
It's early this year.
I could be obsessed with that day. All right, let's do that. That way everybody can go have lunch.
So moved.
Wait, okay, so...
It's on the menu.
We're coming back to source of income. We still want the answers to those questions, please.
Right.
And the chart for Tom.
Yes.
Motion to adjourn.
Wait, there's receiving files on the agenda, if I could just put them.
Where are they?
They're on the agenda. Some appointments that were already taken care of.
Oh, so moved all of them. I so move all those changes from Melanie.
Michael, hold on. Annie Farrell. Yeah, I second them.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right, any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Is there a second?
All aye.
In favor? Aye.
Aye, aye, aye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. See, I give you fun laws to work on. Not just easy stuff. We got a real thing in the county.
Thank you. Mount Abenandi.